Call the meeting of the Veterans Affairs, Finance, and Policy Division order. We do have a quorum with five, so I will ask if Representative Becker Finn will approve the minutes.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. I should know better than that. Motion approved, thank you. First up today, sorry about the meeting room change. I believe for the most part we are going to be in Capitol 120, but there was an education committee that was having a joint committee hearing today, and they asked if we would be willing to switch rooms with them. My personal preference would be to stay right here, but I guess I don't have a personal preference on where our meeting room's at. So I expect next week we'll be back in Capitol 120. So. First up today is a presentation from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, Benjamin Johnson, Legislative Director. And he's here ready to go. Benjamin, if you could state your name for the record and can be ready to begin.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Johnson. I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. To the new faces, welcome. Thank you for your willingness to serve on this committee. To the returning members, thank you for your continued interest in supporting Minnesota's veterans and serving on this committee. A little background on myself. I am a veteran of the United States Navy. I withdrew from college and enlisted in the Navy following the events of September 11th. Spent 6 years active duty. Did three deployments, two in support of OIF in the Persian Gulf. Did a third deployment in South America, working with South American navies doing training, and then a couple of months doing counter-drug operations with the U.S. Coast Guard. Following my enlistment, my wife and I decided to move home to Minnesota, finished my undergraduate degree using Minnesota the GI Bill, finished my law degree using the Minnesota GI Bill in part, and have had the opportunity to work with MDVA for the past more than 4 years, 3 years running the legislative shop. It's a really important mission. I'm proud of the work that we do, and I hope that you are as proud of the work that you do as I am of our veterans and service members. To give an overview of the agency, it's a lot. We do a lot. We also collaborate a lot. So if there are things here that look familiar to you and you didn't know that it's something that MDVA works on, or if there are things in here that you have questions about, I welcome interruptions and questions during the presentation. If you'd like to hold them to the end, I'm fine with that as well. So let's get started.
Well, that was my question, Mr. Johnson. Members, we can take questions as we go. Let's just try to keep on topic and go ahead. Thank you.
So a quick preview of what we'll be covering today. The agency itself is divided into programs and services and healthcare. The last slide before questions is the new state veterans home, so a quick update on those. Pretty self-explanatory. Our job is to serve the needs of Minnesota veterans and their families. We provide proven and innovative programs and services to maximize their quality of life. And we do so through our Programs and Services Division, our Veterans Healthcare Division, and then collaboration and cooperation with the various veterans service organizations within the state of Minnesota and at the federal level. Give you some idea of who we're working on behalf of. We have more than 327,000 veterans in the state of Minnesota. We have veterans in all 87 counties. And my generation of veterans makes up about 70,000 Minnesotans who have served post 9/11. That average age is below mine, but you will likely know young servicemen and women in your communities who have served since 9/11. It's a pretty good chunk of our veterans population. Below that, you'll see a couple of graphs that talk about the demographics, and I think these are important to note. You'll see the highest number of aged veterans in the state of Minnesota is that range between 65 and 74. You'll recall that likely coincides with our Vietnam-era veterans. We've got the tail end of the World War II and Greatest Generation, and a pretty good cross-section of 75 and older in Minnesota a good portion of them are veterans. In Minnesota, we currently have about 8% of the veterans population are women. We expect that number to rise upwards to 14 to 15% in the next 10 to 15 years. Women are serving at a higher level than they used to, and so we will see that demographic shift. More women serving means more veterans in Minnesota. So in terms of headcount and employees, our programs and services division is smaller than our healthcare division, simply by virtue of the healthcare side being 24-hour, 7-day-a-week operations. But that does not mean to suggest that the programs and services is any less valuable or any less present in the state of Minnesota. Programs and services administers programs to meet the needs of eligible veterans, their dependents, and survivors. I'm going to give you a quick overview of what we're looking at and then go through piece by piece. So as I mentioned, programs and services, although it might be smaller in terms of a headcount, it is wide-ranging, everything from federal claims assistance at the federal VA level to our homeless veterans initiatives, our grants programs, education and employment through our partnerships in-house and partnerships with colleges and the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And our state veterans benefits division is also, the director there is also responsible for our memorial affairs and cemeteries.
Mr. Johnson, on that, right off the start on this federal claims assistance, are you seeing any effect of this federal shutdown on what's happening here in the state of Minnesota as far as finances or claims assistance type things?
Chairman, no. At this time, the federal VA was funded last year, so they are not currently experiencing the government shutdown. We know we have some employees, some veterans who are employees of other federal offices. TSA obviously employs some veterans, but in terms of processing claims, to my knowledge, we haven't seen any impact there.
All right. Thank you.
So our claims offices are located at the Whipple Building in St. Paul, right by the International Airport, and we have another in Fargo. We represent veterans and their dependents, and responsibilities include claims development, submittal of evidence, support service-connected claims, pension assistance, evaluation of VA decisions, and assisting veterans with the appeals process up to and including federal hearings. Our field and tribal operations do outreach to groups of claimants who perhaps wouldn't normally seek benefits due to cultural differences, maybe geographic location, areas that don't have access to a lot of resources. Our claims and field operations act as a liaison in various state and federal programs. This is one area where we understand that there can be some issues. The tribal governments and the reservations in Minnesota are at the direct are directly supported by the federal government, and so this is one area where we've been trying to be aware of any issues and concerns at that level. Again, I haven't heard specific to the VA process being as they were funded last year, but it is an area that we're actively monitoring to try and make sure that no one falls by the wayside there. Our SSAP, or State Soldiers Assistance Program, is one of our earliest programs. It includes shelter and utilities, optical and dental benefits, cash grants where necessary, education benefits, and special needs grants. This is one that you may have heard of. The special needs grant is a program. It's a one-time use for any veteran in the state of Minnesota who is facing some significant change in circumstance. The example that I give frequently is not everyone has $4,000 or $5,000 laying around to replace a hot water heater or a central air system in Minnesota. You lose your heating in January, and you don't have money in the bank to remedy that situation. It can quickly spiral into an issue where you're running out of funds quickly and having to make some tough decisions. So MDVA has the Special Needs Grant Program. We work with our partners at the County Veterans Service level to develop grant applications. Again, this is a one-time request for funding, but it is in those cases where there is something serious that has gone on and the veteran has no other alternatives. We want to make sure that we can help them deal with whatever that significant issue is. No less important are the dental and optical benefits. These are for low-income or limited asset veterans, an opportunity to get dental care taken care of, the annual checkups, or in the case of a veteran who has gone too far without the annual checkups, they might need they might need dentures. And so we have a program that we work with our partners in the community, providing vouchers to have an extraction done and then the purchase of dentures for veterans. The optical is what it sounds like, glasses. Not every veteran has access to funds to have their eye exams done or to purchase glasses, and this is an opportunity to help them in that regard. Link Vet is our nation-leading program providing information on veterans' benefits. It's staffed 7 days a week, including some evening hours. This is a primary point of contact for someone who may not have access to their county veteran service officer in the immediacy of an issue. They can call 1-888-LINK-VET. And another phone number that I would like to get on the record is the Veterans Crisis Line. This is the number for the crisis line is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. It's a confidential crisis line through the federal VA for veterans considering or contemplating suicide or for family members or friends who might see a veteran exhibiting behaviors that are concerning. It is the phone number to give out if someone is asking, who do I call? But I'll also quote a deputy commissioner who reminds me and will take every opportunity to tell you, veterans are people too. If there's an emergency and you can't get a hold of someone at the VA or the county veteran service officer, 911 works just as well to make sure that that veteran has a response on the way. So let's not forget the resources that are in place that apply to all citizens of the state. The Minnesota Service Corps Program, Case Management, Outreach, Referral, and Education, is a partnership with Lutheran Social Services in this case. They are the organization that administers this program on a contract basis. They receive funding from MDVA and provide counseling, family counseling, financial counseling, addiction and mental health counseling, disability services, and in-home counseling. This is an important issue in greater Minnesota, especially. These programs are generally available in metro areas, especially the Twin Cities area, but in greater Minnesota, it can be difficult to access these kinds of programming. So partnering with the Lutheran Social Services has been a really positive outcome for us. In fact, so positive that last year, the entire allotment of funding was expended before the end of the fiscal year. We were able to transfer some money from SSAP into the LSS program to keep them going. They used that up in about 6 weeks. They came back to us with still a month left in the fiscal year and said, thank you for your help. Rather than trying to scramble to find more money, we're going to continue to just offer these services. And they ate the cost. So Lutheran Social Services was willing to continue their service to our veterans and communities at no cost. It is a great collaboration and important partnership, and that demonstrated to us their commitment to this mission of serving veterans. So I did want to give a shout out to them for that, and we're hoping that we can continue to support this program.
We have a question here, Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to jump back to that Link Vet. No, that's the number, the crisis line, and so on and so forth.
Chair, Representative, there are two numbers there. Link Vet is not the crisis. I apologize. I transferred quickly. The Link Vet number is basically a 1-800 number to access information about veterans benefits in the state of Minnesota. It's a staff call center that we work with. The crisis line is the suicide line, and when I talk about that, the number that I gave you is the emergency line for veteran suicide.
Okay,
the issue. So I apologize that I wasn't clear.
No, that's okay. With that being said, can I ask one more?
Representative Gossel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That information, they call in on that looking for help. Is that kept confidential? No one else has access to that? Can't be used for any other purposes?
Jarek Lynn, Representative, that's correct. In addition, you can do a confidential crisis chat line online if you want to do a text conversation, but it is confidential. That's certainly a concern of actually the active duty members sometimes think this is really going to impact my career if I reach out to somebody for help for mental health issues. That's not the case, but it is the perspective of a lot of veterans. And it is also a concern of veterans that it might impact their health care provision. And our concern is always getting them on the phone with someone to talk through their options. And if confidentiality is what is necessary, then absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Also under programs and services is our Veterans Homelessness and Prevention Office. We use what's called the SOAR program, which is SSISSDI, Outreach, Access, and Recovery. It's designed to increase access to SSI for those eligible veterans who are experiencing or at risk of homelessness. It's important because for those who may need a specific, a quick resolution, accessing the funding of Social Security and disability payments is a great way to move the needle on ensuring that they have access to eventually housing. We also have our Homeless Veterans Registry, numbers that were quoted last week by Commissioner Herkey in this committee, 237 currently on the list of identified veterans that are homeless. I would like to point out that we have had some success since December, up until December of last year. We have found housing solutions for 1,650 veterans. So we're moving in the right direction, but the registry is a great opportunity to connect with other community providers, St. Stephen's, Catholic Charities, working with shelters and our partners in counties and cities to make sure that that every veteran has a few minutes every month, getting an update, understanding who else is serving this veteran, what kind of resources they need, trying to find solutions for them. The goal, obviously, is functional zero for homelessness. It is a priority of the agency, the commissioner, Governor Walz, yourself, Chair. And the way that we get there is continuing to do case-by-case analysis and make sure that every veteran has access to some sort of solution. Non-recurring and brief is the goal for any veteran at risk of homelessness, and that's our goal as well.
So, Mr. Johnson, on that, if I could ask, there's some areas that are doing better than others. So is the agency keeping track of the ones that are doing well, or is there any data that could be shared across the state for, you know, if, I mean, some counties are doing well and some aren't on a veterans homelessness issue. Is the agency able to track that type of success stories, I guess?
Chair, thank you for the question. That's accurate. We do track. What we have are regional continuums of care, and these regions are grouped geographically generally, but they are made up of cities, counties, and communities that are tracking individual veterans and working with us and at the federal level to make sure that they are achieving that functional zero. We are tracking those and work with those communities extensively. The challenges that are present in the metro, the reason that there are veterans that are still homeless in the seven county metro area, there's a wide variety of issues. Primary among them are lack of access to affordable housing, a pretty low vacancy rate. The other challenge is accessing caseworkers to make sure that veterans that are still on this list, who have issues with mental health, chemical dependency, substance abuse, or others, chronic unemployment, those sorts of things. Those are the hardest to place simply by virtue of not being able to have a case manager. So a lot of rental properties may be hesitant to rent to somebody if they don't have a phone number they can call at 2 a.m. on a Saturday morning and say, this veteran's causing issues and he's not responsive to me. How do we get there? So, but we're working to develop those sorts of solutions and continue to move the needle as best we can. We are also working with our partners with the veteran service organizations, those that make up the Commander's Task Force. They have a very large presence in the metro area, and so identifying things that work and partnering with those in greater Minnesota to address this issue is something that we're working very diligently on.
Thank you.
Our higher education veterans program, we have staff on campuses at veteran resource centers, comprehensive education information available throughout the state of Minnesota, campus institutional readiness in support of the unique needs of veterans. These are the prerogative and responsibility of our higher education team. In addition to that, through the Minnesota Higher Education, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs Higher Education team also works with OJT and apprenticeship. These are areas that we understand not all veterans want to come back and do a standard four-year degree. They might be interested in some technical training. And so the higher education team also works with the unions and trade groups to try and give other opportunities to our veterans. We're really proud of the Minnesota GI Bill. Most of you are familiar with some of the federal funding that's available, federal GI Bill benefits that veterans earn. Minnesota has an additional $10,000 to all eligible Minnesotans. This is basically a last dollar in program and allows us to help a veteran get through, in some cases, their last semester of higher education, or if they need funding to take a licensing exam, the Minnesota GI Bill can be utilized for that, a nursing license or something like that. If they need assistance getting into a union position and have some apprenticeship requirements, the Minnesota GI Bill can be utilized to pay the veteran for their time. We also use it to encourage employers to give veterans an opportunity so that payments can be made to the employer as well, make it easier for both parties to benefit from that veteran's learning on the job.
Okay, Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just on that very thing, I think I heard something in there, but I'm not sure if I did for sure. They can use it for the trades. They can use this their education benefits or the trades shops around here, like the one in Hinckley, the one in St. Paul here, carpenters and the equipment.
Chair Eklund, Representative, that's correct.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, how is that going with the trades and with the opportunities that the legislation we passed last year? Are veterans taking advantage of it?
Chair Eklund, Representative Detmer, yes. I don't have the hard data yet. It hasn't been a full cycle. But anecdotally, we've seen a lot of people accessing that. We're also developing our technology to better handle and process those sorts of applications to make sure that anyone who's interested in pursuing a career in the trades, that it's an easy process for them and for their employer, their OJT team. So once we've got a full year under the belt, I will be happy to bring more detailed information about access and usage.
Yeah, just to follow up, Mr.
Yep.
Chair,
that
would be good, Mr. Johnson. That would be good. We could get that information out to the county service officers too, and they could get some information out to our veterans population also.
And one thing along that line, Mr. Johnson, is I know some of our community colleges in northern Minnesota have been doing some. Work on some CDL stuff for truck drivers. We're tremendously short of truck drivers throughout the industry, but especially in our timber-intensive areas in northern Minnesota. So maybe if we start talking about to the veteran services officers about those programs and start partnering with community colleges too, because there's a lot of small programs going on across the state that maybe some of our veterans could take advantage of.
Chair, I appreciate that. I'll make sure that we have additional information on those kinds of programs, and we're doing the right outreach to the right people.
Thank you.
So as I mentioned earlier, our OJT and apprenticeship program is a great opportunity for veterans who aren't necessarily interested in the traditional four-year higher education process. The other two under our education employment team, the state approving agency and then our Veterans Preference Act is veterans have preference in some areas of employment through state, county, and some local areas. We want to make sure that this state law is adhered to, and so accessing preference points in applying for jobs or being allowed to interview for positions. Most veterans aren't looking for a handout; they just want an opportunity, and this is one of those areas where we can give them access to an additional opportunity. Finally, under programs and services, excuse me, I got one more. Next to last on programs and services are cemeteries and memorial affairs. We currently have functional cemeteries operating in Little Falls and Preston. We did our first burials in Duluth last fall. We will be doing a grand opening this year once we've had an opportunity to finish all the landscaping. And Redwood County is also legislatively authorized for southwestern Minnesota. So in the end, we will have four state veterans cemeteries. A lot of times, all of the previous benefits that I've mentioned aren't something that a veteran's interested in, and I've heard told that occasionally the only thing a veteran wants after their service is a flag for their family. And so it's our goal to make sure that every veteran who wants a dignified burial, either in a state veteran cemetery or in a cemetery in their home communities, have access to the right kinds of graveside services.
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, this is maybe just a comment that this is something that maybe as a committee we could be doing. You know, we have the current five veterans homes and then the Little Falls, Preston, and Duluth cemeteries. If maybe in the future when the weather warms up, we could maybe take a tour of some of these facilities that the state is funding. So,
Representative Detmer, that seems like a great idea for a road trip when weather gets nice. So. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair, we'd be happy to have any and all of you. Now, our grants program, these are limited to broad picture here, veteran service organizations, CVSOs, MACV, and our SOT grants. I'll highlight a few of these. The CVSOs receive grants. Every county has a CVSO, and they are our boots on the ground. They are county employees. They're not state employees, but we work extensively with them, help them with training. We do coverage when CVSOs need to take leave for health reasons or finding a new opportunity. MDVA can staff those offices. We do a lot of training with the CVSOs. And grants are another way of making sure that the state is supporting the activities of county veteran service officers. Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans is a group that we work with extensively on homeless veterans initiatives. They are located in various communities in the state of Minnesota, and I understand it'll be something that this committee will be hearing more about in coming weeks, so I'll leave that one alone. Finally, the Support Our Troops grants. Support Our Troops license plates are, in essence, specialty plates sold by public safety, and a portion of the contribution to the purchase of those plates is sent to Military Affairs and Veterans Affairs. A couple of years ago, MDVA sought and received permission from the legislature to run grants programs so that the money coming in from the SOT license plates can be used to give grants to organizations and foundations whose goal is supporting and improving the lives of veterans. This is an interesting way to develop some new ideas. The concept would be similar to seed money for a startup. These groups come to MDVA, and we've got a panel of veteran and subject matter experts who review applications. Up to $100,000 is available to any given organization, and it can be anything from assistance with purchasing mobility, vans, buses, the like, to providing training opportunities for service animals. So really, this is the innovative portion, is the community saying we've got some ideas, and it's not going through the legislative process or the federal VA big government process. It is small operations and generally speaking, organizations that have a good idea and want to get some funding for it. So the SOT grant program is a great way to help develop some new and innovative ways of serving veterans and their families. So as Representative Detmer alluded to, we currently have five state veterans homes. Four of them are skilled nursing facilities located in Fergus Falls, Silver Bay, Laverne, and Minneapolis. We also have a veterans home in Hastings that is a domiciliary or a board and care. So it is not a skilled nursing facility, but it is one of our five veterans homes. We also have a 50-bed DOMS building at the Minneapolis campus as well. This is a slide that talks a little bit about an earlier slide. I had a slide up at the beginning that talked about the demographics in the state of Minnesota and our veterans population. These are some key findings on aging in Minnesota, generally speaking. So this slide is a year and a half old, but the numbers hold true. The number of Minnesotans generally turning 65 in this decade will be greater than the past four decades combined. The number of quote-unquote older adults, those identified as 65 and older, again, this is not my definition. This is just a way to convey what we're talking about. That number is expected to double in the next 10 years. So by then, more than 20% of Minnesotans will be an older adult, which is the entire baby boom generation. I mentioned earlier that our greatest generation is passing away. We don't have as many World War II veterans left, but that baby boom generation and those who served in Vietnam, that number is increasing, and it is a significant portion of what we will be dealing with. Our biggest challenge, as far as we can see, is the ability to secure the services of qualified caregivers. Because of these aging Minnesotans numbers, MDVA and our skilled nursing facilities are going to continue to be squeezed. So there is collaboration between our higher education team and our homes team to try and figure out ways of collaborating to develop more skilled nursing and basically the on-the-line troops who are staffing our homes around the clock, providing bedside care. This is our greatest concern, and our challenge is to continue to find and or develop employees for our homes to provide the care that we owe to our veterans. So our commitment is to provide innovative customer care and services to our veterans. Our commitment is to optimize and implement clinical capacity. That means that we are doing our best to be at the forefront of the right kinds of care. We've done campus revitalization at Minneapolis, which resulted in three new buildings. The goal there was CMS certification, individual rooms and bathrooms for our residents, and making sure that they are receiving the highest quality of care and meeting or exceeding industry standards. Finally, and not insignificantly, ensuring fiscal integrity by making sure that any and all supplemental resources that we can access, things like Medicare, Medicaid, the various parts of Medicare that we can access, that we are receiving reimbursements from the feds for these kinds of provisions of care. We are our veterans' primary care provider, so we also partner with the VA to make sure that the veteran residents are receiving care through the VA for specialty programs. I'd like to highlight the third bullet on this slide: partnership with VSOs, educational institutions, and other stakeholders. That's key. We're working with St. Catharines University and I believe Invergrove Community College to develop some nursing programs to get on-the-job training for nurses so that we could then eventually turn around and hire these people that we're helping to train. Partnerships with VSOs, there's going to be a slide at the end here talking about our new fixed dental clinic. That was a partnership with Delta Dental, DAV of Minnesota, and V4V to help upgrade a space to provide dental clinic on the Minneapolis campus for our ongoing residential care.
Mr. Johnson, on that note, and I think Representative Grossel could probably attest to this from where he's from, currently any of our health facilities in greater Minnesota is having a tremendously tough time retaining RNs. But I don't even think that's the key to this whole thing. I think the key to this whole thing is going to be the backbone, and that is making sure that we have the CNAs available to run these operations, because they do the backbone of the work. And currently in International Falls, where I'm from, the nursing home, the hospital are running ads continuously for CNAs, plus the nursing home is doing continuous training for CNAs. So I think that's a real concern that we're going to have to take a look at, and how we're going to staff these new facilities.
Chair, absolutely, and I would add that I think it's also an opportunity in talking about all the things that my generation of veterans are looking to do, maybe tapping into some of these areas where there is going to be job growth, where there are going to be opportunities. It's not going to be cheap. There's a significant demographic who are aging and are going to need help. But we also view it as an opportunity to identify areas where a career could be had. Not as a CNA, perhaps, but the healthcare side of it and the provision of care in our skilled nursing facilities is significant. And as you noted, it's not all that unique in terms of the larger picture of skilled nursing or healthcare.
Thank you.
Just a quick cross-section of the kind of services that we provide. You'll note the primary care, we have staff on hand, both physicians and nurse practitioners. We are 24/7. Fifth bullet down on the left is the adult daycare. This is a unique program at the Minneapolis campus, one of only three, I think, in the nation. And really what it is a drop-off and an opportunity for respite for veterans who are still living at home, receiving care from their spouses. The Minneapolis Adult Daycare Center is a place where they can be dropped off so that the caregiver at home can go do some grocery shopping or maybe go to the library or get a cup of coffee for themselves. Our goal is to keep veterans in their homes for as long as possible. The least restrictive environment is our goal. So the Minneapolis Adult Day Center is one of those places where we can continue to support veterans in the community who aren't residents. I was asked a question in the Senate on this about spouses being able to access adult daycare who may not be the veteran. They're eligible as well. We don't get any sort of reimbursement from the federal VA for the spouse of a caregiver. So for a minor amount payment, a veteran could drop their spouse if the veteran is the primary caregiver and the spouse is the one who would need to come in. And the adult daycare center is an interesting model in that we don't provide direct medical care, but we can help with the distribution of the medication or help with bathing, which is not always an easy task, meals, and really just an opportunity to get them out of the house and provide them some entertainment, whether it be just an opportunity to chat with other veterans so that they can get out of the home. Sometimes that is all that they're looking for. So we're really proud of that program. Our biggest challenge is the daily census. We'd like to get as many people aware of it as we can. And so simply put, we can take more. We'd like to see more.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Johnson, does this also apply, say, if a veteran is living with a son or daughter, do they still qualify for this program?
Chair Eklund, Representative, absolutely.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I guess I'll open any specific questions on this list of services that we do provide. Anything catch your eye or anything you'd like to hear more about specifically here? Otherwise, I can move on.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Deborah.
Yeah, Mr. Johnson, I know you mentioned the dental program that we started at the Minneapolis home. Could you maybe just share a little more with the committee here and how that came to be? It's a one of a kind. So, and I think this is something that maybe we're looking at for the some of the other veterans' homes also.
Absolutely. Yeah. Chair Eklund, Representative Deborah, the fixed dental clinic at the Minneapolis campus is actually located in a Building 6, which is one of our historic buildings. There was identified a need for a fixed dental clinic. Typically, we do mobile dental care. Trucks with trailers come and set up shop, and you can get veterans in to provide dental care, which is a significant area of concern. Dental care is really important, a really important area of health care by extension. But we couldn't get as many veterans into these mobile trailers as we would have liked. A lot of our veterans have mobility issues. So the concept was developed for a fixed dental clinic. Deputy Commissioner Doug Hughes and Senior Director Hogan on the healthcare side worked with Dr. Marcus Peters from Elder Care Dental, I believe is his organization, developed a concept and then went out and secured some contributions. And so, as I mentioned earlier, the V4V Trust, Delta Dental and DAV of Minnesota contributed funds to the actual construction portion. We're still working out the sort of the best practices in terms of the business deal. We've only been open for about 8 months now. But the goal would be to have fixed dental available at all of our skilled nursing facilities. Until we figure out best practices in terms of providing the care and also making sure that we're being reimbursed properly and that the caregivers are being reimbursed, we're monitoring that now. But it looks like an opportunity to do more, we're excited about the partnership. I think that's the thing that was most encouraging is there are a lot of organizations that are willing to step up. Currently, we only provide care to residents of our Minneapolis home, but there's a thought that we might be able to help address some of the overflow need at the Minneapolis VA healthcare system. That's still in the works. It hasn't happened yet, but it's an idea about how we could then be partnering with our federal counterparts to provide dental care to some of those veterans as well. So.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
So we have annual surveys from various organizations, including Department of Health from Minnesota, the federal VA, and we also do some of our own where we do outreach and figure out where can we improve. Continuous improvement is something that is significant to our healthcare team, and so these are some areas where we have received best-in-class ratings. It's the brag sheet, but it's an interesting one in that you see everything from quality of care to the admissions process. There are a lot of places where the process of moving a loved one into a long-term skilled nursing facility, knowing full well that they likely will never come out, we want to make sure that every facet of that process is as palatable and well done as possible. So it's not just for our resident veterans, but it's for their families as well. Also, it's for our staff. The better we do on behalf of our staff, the better we can do overall. So the happiness and contentment of our staff directly impacts how we provide care for our veterans.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, best in class, is that a reference to all of them comparatively, or is it standalone, each one of them gets a ranking 1 through 5, 5 stars to 1 star?
Chair Eklund, Representative, each of them are individually identified. So this is a relatively generic slide talking about all of them, but each of them have these ratings. Each of them can claim best in class. All four of the skilled nursing that receive those annual surveys, and then the DOMS as well in terms of the care that we provide. So I think the best in class, the best part about it is that it's not us just claiming it. It's an outside agency reviewing the process, reviewing the homes, and making that determination. And so we're really proud of that. And we are all, other than the Hastings home, which is the DOMS, our homes are all CMS certified, we've finalized all of that. So Centers for Medicare and Medicaid CMS certification is a significant benchmark for quality, and we're proud that we're able to offer that at all of our skilled nursing homes.
Thank you.
Oh, Representative Grossel.
Just back to that helmets to hard hats with the trades and such. Just did a little numbers gathering here, and it went from with being able to use their educational benefits for that type of work, for that type of schooling, it has increased from 70 to 300 as far as people utilizing that and taking advantage of that program. So that's just the beginning of some really good things that I think you've done here for the veterans. So that's to be able to keep working with them. You know, you talk about the need for good workforce to man these homes and such. You know, if these people have that accessibility to go into the trades, to go into nursing, things like that, I mean, that could be a good answer for a lot of the needs that our veterans' homes will have.
Thank you for sharing that.
And, Chair, I'd like to add another program is the Veterans to Ag. Veterans to Agriculture is one that's also seen some success. It was a pilot program, been around for, I think, a couple of years. It is also showing promise, and it's one of those areas where you forget about the challenges of accessing agriculture if you don't have a background in agriculture. So, again, sort of outside-the-box thinking, and we're proud to support those programs. So this is, I mentioned the renovation of the Minneapolis campus. This is the exterior of Minneapolis Building 22, which is the final newest building, opened last year. We are doing final preparations for our 12-person loft unit. Now, the loft unit is important because, as you might know, sometimes aging residents suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's have a propensity to wander. So the loft unit allows us to provide a safe and secure environment for them. It's not as intimidating as it sounds, really. It's just a secure way to monitor and make sure that we don't have anyone disappearing who might not just might not understand their own circumstances. So, but it's a great opportunity because there aren't very many locked units for long-term skilled nursing in the state of Minnesota. So we're proud to offer that. We'll fill it internally, but it will be an option going forward that we didn't previously have.
So on that, Mr. Johnson, on that lock unit, and this is probably being a former county commissioner question, if a veteran is placed on a 24-hour hold by a county, would that lock unit be available to them rather than them being transported to wherever we have to transport people in this system, which is doesn't work, but that's a topic for another committee?
The quick answer is no. This okay. would be specifically for residents of the facility, and it has to do with the clinical diagnosis as opposed to it being a place to hold. But I am aware of that challenge, and we have spoken a lot with our counterparts at the Minneapolis VA and at the counties about mental health issues in veterans and how do we move forward to try and have some resolution there. So,
okay, thank you.
So we've already covered this, but a couple of pictures of the finished space at the Minneapolis Dick's Dental Clinic. Final slide has to do with the new state veterans' homes. So during the 2018 session, the legislature passed and Governor Dayton signed an omnibus capital investment bill that included $32 million for three new state veterans' homes in the state of Minnesota. Those are the amounts that were allocated. I will tell you that all three of these communities have worked hard to raise their own funding as well, so that the total amount available is significantly more than the 32 that will be used to submit federal applications. The goal at this point is to get the applications submitted the first or second week of April. And for those who are not familiar with this process, we are seeking as a state a 65% match from the federal VA State Home Construction Program for the cost of building these new facilities. I'd like to give a nod, with your permission, Chair. Representative Miller was instrumental and really important advocate for the home in Montevideo, Minnesota, and we're really proud of the work that Montevideo has done to get themselves ready to submit a federal application to the point of really exceeding the ask in terms of local contributions. And they had answers to questions I didn't even know I had. So congratulations to that group out there, and well done. The second portion of this slide is was the good news that we received last year during the middle of session that I think was instrumental, again, in getting some of this federal funding approved. Year over year, the VA's budget for state home construction was anywhere between $75 and $90 million, which is not a significant amount of money when you consider that one brand-new facility can run anywhere from $40 to $60 million. What they did was increase the annual amount from 90 to 110. And then the VA received an additional $2 billion in infrastructure funding, of which $575 million was made available for the construction grants for the State Homes Program. The goal was to eliminate the waiting list of projects that had been submitted to the federal office. We are waiting. I think February is the last word I had, that we will have an idea of how many of the 47 projects that were on the list through last year have been funded. Once that list is released, then we'll understand where our applications for the state of Minnesota will fall on the federal list for funding. Again, it hinges entirely on where these projects, the three projects will be three distinct applications. Where they fall on that federal list is where we can expect to receive funding. We were encouraged to hear from the director of that federal program that she expects that list to be the majority of those projects to receive funding, and so that we would be, the state of Minnesota would be in a good position to receive the federal match to allow us to move forward. So our commitment to the governor is that these applications will be ready to submit so that when the federal VA makes their determinations that we will have done our part to be ready to go. With that, I'm open to any additional questions that might not have come up. I thank you for the extra couple of minutes, Owen, the committee administrator. I appreciate the heads up and the freedom to go with it. Chair Eklund, thank you for your time, and I stand for any questions.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit. I know it's touched on in various areas, but are there any specific programs dealing with addressing suicide and also the ramifications for the families when that does happen, if there are specific programs addressing that?
Chair Eklund, Representative, there are. Veteran suicide sort of generally falls under the oversight of the federal VA. I heard from Director Patrick Kelly this morning talking about, I think they've nearly doubled the amount of providers they have specifically to address mental health and veteran suicide at the Minneapolis VA. There are a plethora of other organizations that are working on behalf of addressing this. It really is a crisis, it's a community crisis, and it's contrary to what a lot of people think. Veteran suicide is not just veterans returning from the battlefield today. It really stretches back all the way to the Korean warrior veterans. All generation of veterans are dealing with it, and it's a crisis that does impact more than just the veteran. It is their family. So there are community resources available. The challenge is trying to find the right fit and make sure that answers are there when the questions are asked, rather than trying to deal with something after the fact. So,
Representative Becker-Finn.
So to follow up with that, I just you know, a lot of times when we read, we see the overviews and we list the programs, you know, we kind of talk around this issue. And so, but I, you know, when I hear from folks in my district too, and it is a crisis, and I just want to make sure we're doing everything that we can, you know, instead of behavioral health addiction program, you know, and just being straight about the need to address this issue. So thanks for the answer.
Representative Deborah.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could turn to page 9. In your books, you might want to, Mr. Johnson, share regarding the assistance programs and how does a veteran know and what if he qualifies for some of these benefits, you know, what does he have to provide? And maybe there's people on the committee here that are not familiar with how veterans do get their assistance and so forth and benefits. But what do they have to do to prove that they qualify for these benefits?
Chair Eklund, Representative Demmer, I appreciate the question. the easiest way to understand what you are eligible for as a service member is to bring a copy of your discharge paperwork to your county veteran service officer. They are, as I mentioned earlier, we call them the boots on the ground. Yeah. We want to make sure that every veteran who either comes home to Minnesota, moves to Minnesota, has family here, have access to an understanding of what veterans programs and benefits might be available. CVSOs are in a great position to do that. You can walk in, you can call them, you can email. They are the clearinghouse of information. Legislators are another good place to go. We hope that your constituents know, especially those of you on this committee, that you can find the answers, that you have the support of the Minnesota Legislature and the House of Representatives, some great researchers and some great staff who can help you determine what they might be eligible for. I'll illustrate a comment that I heard. One of the challenges is with CVSOs is they have a limited amount of money as county employees. Asking a CVSO to do more advertising, for instance, purchase a billboard for 3 months of, hey, call your CVSO, come talk to me about what benefits you've earned. If he has $1,000 to help someone have a mental health evaluation or $1,000 to do a billboard, it's a challenging position to put that CVSO in, and frankly, they're always going to fall in the category of we're going to help with this mental health evaluation. So the other challenge, I think, is not all veterans want the government knowing anything about their service or having anything to do with them. You can't help all veterans, but we want to make sure that those who have an interest have access to that. So we have a presence online. We have a presence on Facebook and Twitter. And we have a legislature full of people who want to serve their constituents, and that includes all of the veterans and their families in the state of Minnesota. So as I've said before, anything I can do for you, any information that you need, I'm happy to help. If you have constituent questions or you have peers in the legislature who need help with something, I'm always here to try and answer questions.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. And I think all of us in the committee, there's 9 members of the committee, and sooner or later you're going to get calls from constituents that are veterans. And the first thing you should do is ask them, have they contacted their county veteran service officer? You know what the answer is going to be usually? No, they haven't. And what you should have next to you is the list of the county veteran service officers by county, and just give them the name and the phone number of these people. And that's usually all they want it from us as legislators for the most part. And we do have research people on the committee here that can help us out. Mr. Johnson and the commissioner, they're always, and staff that you have, they're always available to help us as legislators to get the answers out to our constituents. So this is a great, again, a great committee to serve on. And I have one last question.
Representative Detmer.
Last year, the legislative report, auditor report, found that the Department of Veterans Affairs did not comply with the Administrative Procedure Act in terms of establishing guidelines for governing the adult daycare center and center pharmacy. MDVA responded in a report, and we read the report, that stated that you anticipate the completion of the 9050 amendment on December 2018. Has that rule been accomplished? And if not, if you can't answer that, Ryan, you can get back to the committee on that.
Chair Eklund, Representative Denver, yes. The draft of the 9050, which is the rules that have to do with our veterans' health care side, have been submitted to the reviser, came back with questions, and we're working on responses to those questions. So, yes, the initial drafting went well. We are on pace to get it approved. The reviser had some clarifications that they're seeking, and we're working on addressing those. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
So our county veteran service officers do a great job. Is there does your agency provide them a punch list, or not really a punch list, but a list for dealing with issues? I mean, I know the county I'm from, the CVSO is great, but they're not all created equal either. So is there something that they can work off of that's provided by your agency?
Chair, absolutely. So our team down at the Whipple building also do a good chunk of the annual training requirements to keep the CVSOs certified and up to speed on what's going on at the federal level. So within that training program, we provide assistance. But the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers also has an internal training team to make sure that the right information is getting out consistently to all CVSOs. An interesting component, you could liken it to forum shopping, but you're not obligated to see the CVSO in your county. Not all county veteran service officers are created equal, as you might be well aware. but you can go to any CVSO you would like to help process a claim or talk about your concerns. They are all there to help veterans no matter where they're residents. So.
Okay, thank you. Representative Purcell.
Real quick, I just wonder perhaps in going to your Representative Detmer's question there, that, and including the tribal veteran service officers and have their phone handy, could we get a list of the county veteran service officers and tribal veteran service officers and to us, and then I would offer following up Representative Detmer that maybe we'd provide it to all our members in the House.
Mr. Johnson, if you provide that to the committee and then we could get it passed around, I'd appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, this is not, I apologize, I was a little late. Come in, I had a meeting that went a little longer than expected, but I don't know if you already covered this, but I'm just curious, is there information on where geographic-wise many of our veterans are located? And I ask that because I'm just curious, you know, I realize that we have a lot of facilities here that are in big cities, and I just want to know how has accessibility been an issue for a lot of our veterans.
Chair Ackland, Representative, we have breakdowns. We delivered a copy of our annual report to the House mailboxes, and that includes a breakdown by county on the number of veterans, the number of federal funds coming back to serving those veterans. In terms of basic demographics, the veterans population mirrors the population at large. A significant portion of our veterans live in the 7-county metro area. Some of our highest concentration counties for veterans are Ramsey County, Hennepin County, Dakota County, Anoka County. So we do have a significant concentration of veterans in the Twin Cities metro area, as well as some of our larger communities in greater Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I don't want to shortchange the next presentation, but members, this is a great group, and if you have any questions, you can get a hold of Mr. Johnson or others, and he'll direct you to the right staff people to get in touch. So thank you for the presentation.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So, Mr. Kerr, if you want to come down. Oh, there he is. We'll get you set up. And that was quick, so please identify yourself for the record and welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you. My name is Don Kerr. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Department of Military Affairs. I am a retired Army officer. I've actually been 10 years retired now, and in October it will be 40 years since I first enlisted in the Minnesota National Guard, so I'm coming up on four decades of affiliation with my agency, so I'm pretty proud of that. It's a great organization to be affiliated with, and I'm going to take you through a little overview of the National Guard and the Department of Military Affairs, of which the National Guard is a part. That's the agenda for today's briefing. So the National Guard is unique in that we actually owe two allegiances, one to the president and one to the governor as commanders-in-chief. Most of the time, the National Guard is under the control of the governor in the various states and territories, but can, under certain circumstances laid out in federal law, be called into active service in support of national initiatives. So the National Guard has components of both the Army and the Air Force. And today, about 13,150-ish service members that serve in the National Guard in Minnesota. The Adjutant General, Major General John Jensen, took the reins about 14 months ago on 1 November of 2018, so he's had a little bit of time to get into the saddle. Of course, he was a longstanding senior leader in the organization, so it wasn't a big transition. But this is his vision, and on the next slide will be his priorities. I think it's very important to look at this. It's not a huge change from Major General Nash and his tenure, but General Jensen really wanted to make sure that we understood that we're a people-based organization, both the Army and the Air National Guard, and that's our first priority, is to make sure that we can take care of our people. And that includes not just our service members, but also their families, their employers. it's very important for us to grow our own leaders inside, because that's how the military system works. So therefore, leader development is very important to the Adjutant General. We have to make sure that we're protecting our resources and our people so that they're available to perform the missions that are required. We take fiscal and property responsibility very seriously and try to be the best stewards of our resources that are provided to us by you and the federal government, so that we can make those go the furthest. And we also think it's important to conduct outreach to make sure that we're communicating and partnering with other organizations, because we're stronger with others than we are on our own.
Representative Grossel, excuse me.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Caught my ear when you said you want to take care of these people, make sure they have everything they need, make sure that they're safe. You recall the guards being deployed to Lithuania?
Yes.
Okay. Can you answer a question for me as to why our servicemen, our soldiers, were there without ammunition?
Sure.
And who makes that call? And when there's other nations there also in support, they're fully armed, fully loaded.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grossel, yes. So that particular mission was service in Title 10 for the federal government. And really the mission is one to enhance our NATO relationship, and it was a show of force operation to deter potential Russian aggression. With regard to the ammunition issue, that decision was made by the theater level commander, so the commander U.S. Army EUCOM, European Command, and then the Army U.S. Army in Europe commander, the USRA commander, both had input into that decision, and the assessment was made that it was not necessary to have live ammunition on hand at the time, because there was no particular grave threat of interference from a foreign power.
Representative Grossel.
From that foreign power, we're talking about Russia. Lithuania's breaking from that, and they saw that there was no threat. See, I take personal interest in this because my son was there. Mm-hmm. And a lot of other sons, brothers, and husbands, fathers were there. And you have other nations that are fully armed, prepared to be able to defend and to stave off any kind of attempt. But when we've got the best troops on the planet sitting there without ammunition in a place like that's to me, that's unacceptable, and I hope that never happens again.
Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification here. Did the soldiers have their weapons and no ammunition, or did the soldiers go there without their weapons as well?
Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, they did have their weapons. And I served in the Army in Europe, and I have a high level of confidence that the best army in the world could have gotten them the ammunition very rapidly had it been necessary, and that the best intelligence operation in the world also would have had the indicators and warnings necessary to determine when those decisions had to be made. So I understand your position, sir, but I also respect the leadership that was in place at the time, and I have confidence in the decision.
Continue, Mr. Kerr.
So, Mr. Chair, I'll start by saying this slide is wrong. We figured this out a couple of days ago, that somehow we're missing a whole bunch of money here. And it does show up in a later slide. The good news is I'm sure I'm going to have another opportunity to come before the committee again to talk about the fiscal status of the agency and our budget going forward, so we'll be able to fix that. That state economic impact is about half what it should be reading. We know we expended just over $30 million in state funds last year, and we'll show that in a later slide. We also know the federal economic impact was a little bit more than that. The total economic impact of the National Guard in Minnesota in 2018, we estimated about $516 million, so a half a billion dollars of economic impact here in Minnesota. You'll note that there are just over 2,000 full-time employees and about 11,000 non-full-time traditional members who hold jobs in your communities or are students in our universities. We have 61 facilities in 58 communities around the state, and are kind of a big employer a couple places around here in Morrison County and in Duluth. I'll start with the Air National Guard. We have two major units in the Air National Guard, the 133rd Airlift Wing here at Minneapolis-St. Paul. They fly the C-130H3 Hercules transport aircraft. There's a mirror wing there that's in the Air Force Reserve, the 934th Air Force Reserve Wing. Looks just like the 133rd for all intents and purposes, so you'll see about twice as many airplanes as belong to us. That's actually very useful for a lot of reasons. They can share a lot of resources at that base, and that works out really well. The 148th Fighter Wing, of course, flies the F-16 Fighting Falcon, and they actually are equipped with the newest F-16s in the United States Air Force fleet, flying out of Duluth, and their primary mission is the suppression of enemy air defense, though they're also capable of doing air-to-air interdiction. The Army National Guard is a larger organization, and this is distributed throughout the state. Almost 11,000 soldiers in the Army National Guard. We have a number of different large organizations. The Joint Force Headquarters oversees the whole operation, and they're here in St. Paul. We have a Combat Division Headquarters that is currently deployed mostly to Kuwait, but throughout the CENTCOM area responsibility. They're in federal service right now. They'll be returning in July. There's about 700 of them overseas. We have the 1st Armored Brigade Combat Team of the 34th Division. That's the preponderance of the Minnesota National Guard. They're organized around the state, headquartered in Bloomington right now, and they will likely move to Rosemont here in a few years. We also have an Expeditionary Combat Aviation Brigade headquartered in Minnesota with some components of the brigade in Minnesota and others in other states. The Combat Aviation Brigade is actually slated for an upcoming mobilization and deployment in the future, fairly near future. We have a regional support group, the Troop Command, which is the organization in the state that we put the units that don't fit in any one of those other entities, and a regional training institute at Camp Ripley to run our institutional training there. Camp Ripley is a hidden gem in Minnesota, a 53,000-acre training facility that we're very fond of. We can do nearly everything we need to do to conduct military training. The only thing we can't do right now is drop bombs. And we have other places we can do that. Not a big deal. All of the ground maneuver training that we have to do, we're capable of doing it at Camp Ripley. And the installation is also used by many other state agencies doing very important training very economically for the taxpayers of Minnesota.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kerr, on page 9 that we're on, I'm sure nobody drove that truck in the pond. That must be a training exercise. Am I correct?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer, I guarantee you I can find 100 people that would drive that truck into that pond. But you are correct. That was placed there specifically to do training on vehicle recovery operations because soldiers do actually do things like that.
Yeah. That's, an old deuce, that's an old deuce and a half, isn't
that's
it?
That's an old deuce and a half. Yeah. That's right.
Okay.
You can continue. Thank you.
Economic impact at Camp Ripley, $72 million. And I think we'll move on to the next slide. So our statewide presence, as mentioned previously, 61 facilities located in 58 communities around the state. We do believe that this number will shrink slightly as we're looking at some of our older facilities and some of the demographics in Minnesota. We've identified there's going to be a requirement to contract some of our basing. It's going to be pretty incremental, though, and shouldn't be a big deal. But it is still an important resource in many of those smaller communities that the communities really appreciate.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we're on that subject, not that you have this prepared to the detail, but can you let us know in the future what priorities there are in determining which, like the mindset behind what's going to be, choose to be open, which is going to be closed and mm-hmm. stuff like that? That would be good stuff to have in the future. Maybe you're going to do that anyway, but that's something I would like to see at the appropriate time. Thank you.
Mr. Kirk.
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, actually, we do have the data. It's not part of this briefing today, but I'd be happy to come to the committee and present at some future time what our long-range plan is. We have a plan going out 30 years of where we think we need to make investments and where we need to divest of our facilities.
Okay. Thank you.
Our federal mission, obviously, the National Guard changed after 9/11, really changed before 9/11. We were starting to see an impact of expanded use of the National Guard even before the terrorist attacks of 9/11. But clearly, we're doing a lot of work for the feds right now. As I stated, we've got just over 900 service members currently mobilized, serving around the world. Not quite in every continent, but we do have one person in Antarctica. I always like to mention that. We have one member of our Air National Guard wing is down there supporting scientific operations down there. We don't currently have anybody in South America, though, so I can't touch every base in the world. Yes, sir.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that subject, are you able to share with us what probably the trend on mobilization is going to be over the next 5 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, yeah, we expect it to continue at about the current pace, which is actually reduced from previous. But the challenge with that is there could be a major blip. So I can give you some more detailed information, but you know, roughly 1,000 out right now, probably another 1,000 to 1,500 next year, up to 4,500 the year, and I think 2 years after that. So we see the pace of mobilizations and deployment for the current forecast is not getting smaller. We actually have probably lived through the slowest part of life after 9/11, and now we're kind of ramping, seeing that ramp up again. Some of that just has to do with timing, but that's what we're anticipating right now. This is not, we're not going back to an old normal. We're going to continue to see mobilizations and deployments ramp up, and the operational tempo on our force will stress it, and it's going to stress employers, and that's our biggest concern. We're pretty sure the soldiers and their families can take it. We're going to do a lot of things to help support them. Our concern really lies with how are our employers going to deal with repeated extended vacancies, and how often will they just say, you know, I'm just not going to hire those people because they're too hard. And that's a great concern that we have, and that's something we may come back to the committee on in the future, but something that we're watching very closely.
You can continue, Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Chair, so we've operated in dozens of countries around the world. These are the named operations that we have supported since 9/11, and I'm going to move fairly rapidly. I've already kind of delved a little bit into future operations, but we do see mobilizations continuing on the horizon, along with extensive training activities, too. So in addition to just the mobilizations, part of that mobilization process is going through numerous exercises to prepare you for potential deployment, and those exercises alone are often very trying for our service members and their families and their employers. In our state active duty capacity, so as previously stated, most of the time we're under the control of the governor, and we have done a fairly extensive amount of state active duty, though what we found is because in many cases emergency response capabilities in local communities and in counties has expanded over the last 15 years, there have been fewer requirements to call the guard to help with local emergencies, and we're okay with that. But it hasn't gone away. Most significantly, of course, we did use the National Guard to support Super Bowl 52 last year. That accounts for about 3,000 of those 4,000 mandates, and the other 1,000 went to some activities in the state, but many to supporting other states with hurricane response capabilities in the last 2 years. So Minnesota is not unique, but somewhat unique in that of all the 54 states and territories, we have just about the cleanest salami slice of what the Army looks like as any state. So we have a little bit of everything in Minnesota looks very much like the Army. It's that microcosm of the Army. Other states aren't in that same boat. For example, North Dakota has a maneuver enhancement brigade. They have a lot of combat engineers. They don't have a lot of combat forces. They don't have a lot of aviation. They have some. But we actually have of the 10 capabilities listed here, all 10 of those reside in the state of Minnesota. That's good because we don't have to rely on emergency management assistance compacts with other states to meet our core capabilities for support to the state in the event of an emergency. That doesn't mean we won't go there if we run out of a certain capability or if we time out of. One of the things that's evolved in the National Guard is when you have extended missions, it's not usually a for-the-duration kind of commitment. For example, if we're supporting firefighting operations in South Dakota, we'll usually send air crews out for 2 weeks and then replace them with new air crews after a couple of weeks. That's less wear and tear on the individuals. It's less wear and tear on their employers. A little bit more wear and tear on the helicopters because we usually fly them back and forth. But, we think that's an okay trade-off. Oops, went the wrong way. Domestic operations, we have some capabilities that are somewhat unique. Our civil support team, even though they're in the National Guard, they're actually a full-time unit. They are combined Army and Air activity, and their purpose is to assist local authorities in identifying and responding to chemical, nuclear, and biological threats. So they are at the call of local emergency management officials. So if somebody gets a white powder complaint, these are the guys that put on the big suits and go in and figure out what it was. The Emergency Response Force, this is a dual status mission, again, a joint Army and Air team, and their purpose is to go in and support local authorities in the event that they have to do heavy structure collapsed rescue or contaminated structure rescue. So they can do this in the event that a chemical agent is present. They can put on their suits and go in and help rescue people from those circumstances without making anything worse. Small counter drug program that's funded by the feds, and a cyber protection team that we stood up last year and is already starting to make a positive impact in defending us on the cyber community. And of course, we do community support activities as well. Our Yellow Ribbon Reintegration Program is nation-leading. We have modified this program. Actually, the feds have modified this down to a two-step process. So when a unit deploys, after they come home, we have two steps where we bring them in for a post-1 and a post-2 event. And that basically is to do an eye check with all of our service members and their families to make sure that their reintegration process is proceeding as we would like it to, and to offer them services and support in the event that it isn't. In addition to that, we're still doing Family Preparation Academy. So before a deployment, we're bringing family members in along with their service members to talk about the types of things that they might run into on a deployment and help them make arrangements in advance so that those don't become problems for them during the deployment. And then for soldiers who have not deployed before, or even for those who have, we also do an initial soldier preparation prior to deployment. Our Yellow Ribbon Networks are our community outreach activities that we reach out to the local communities, and we kind of have a framework identified so that local communities can sign up and play within this framework to help assist service members and veterans in most cases in their communities. And as of January 2019, 90 Yellow Ribbon Networks across Minnesota and 65 Yellow Ribbon companies have been identified. We're big into education, and one of the things that we probably will talk to you a little bit about later is what we've been able to do with the resources that do come to the state. About half of the resources that come to us in the general fund get rolled right into the state tuition reimbursement program, and what that does is it pays people's tuition that are going to college. So joining the National Guard is truly a good way to get an education, because we will pay for your education. And I'll preempt this a little bit. It's not just baccalaureates and master's programs. It also does any of the trades, any accredited university or college in Minnesota, or outside Minnesota for that matter, as long as they're accredited, technical, community, or other, that tuition is reimbursable. Starbase is actually a federally funded program that we support on two of our installations, both here in Minneapolis and up in Duluth. That generally reaches out to underserved communities. It gives them an immersion to science, technology, engineering, and math, one-week program in each of those grades. More than 50,000 students have participated in that since 1993. We have the longest officially recognized partnership in the Department of Defense with Norway. This will be the 46th exchange, kicking off next month, where approximately 100 U.S. soldiers fly to Norway and approximately 100 Norwegian service members fly back this way, and we conduct training in each other's countries for a couple of weeks, have some cultural activities. Our state partner in the European Command is Croatia. We have assisted them moving from a new fledgling state coming out of the former Yugoslav Republic into a full NATO member and a member of the European Union, and we're very proud of that. And we've actually deployed in units with the Croatians to Afghanistan in combat for extended periods. A little bit of an overview of the Department of Military Affairs. So to color code this for you, the purple boxes indicate joint organizations, green mean Army, blue mean Air, and gray mean generally civilian. So you see the state agency component of the department is over there, and we basically provide support to the National Guard using state resources so that they can meet their federal mission. To give you an idea of the staffing level, each one of those little icons replicates 100 people, so about 300 state employees, and the 11,000 are indicated over there on the right-hand side, and then you can see the Army and Air full-timers that support that match. This is the one that's got the correct numbers on it. Last year, about $30 million in state funding. Through a federal cooperative agreement, that is, the state provides services to the federal government like security guards at military installations, and the federal government reimburses 100% of the cost of that activity. So they're state employees paid out of the state general fund, but the feds reimburse the state general fund for those activities. And that is a $64 million enterprise annually here in Minnesota. And then there is a major amount of direct federal spending that comes through the National Guard for a total of $516 million. Last year. And Mr. Chair, that got me through my briefing, and I will stand for any questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Gerter. We have about 5 minutes left in the committee, so Representative Detmer and then Representative Brand.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kerr, how's the enlistment numbers? How are we doing out there with the Air National Guard and also the National Guard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, so the Air Force typically caps the number of enlistments that they allow, and so we're supposed to be at 100%. We're at about 104.5 which they tolerate, but they're not happy about, but we keep pushing back on that. On the Army side, it's a little bit of a different story. For the last 3 years, the Army and the Army National Guard nationwide have missed their enlistment numbers. The Minnesota National Guard has made their numbers for the last 10 years, and that has allowed us then to expand a little bit. And so right now, the Minnesota Army National Guard is running at about 118 or 119% of its strength, and that's really useful, because what that means is when we have to send out 100% contingent, we have an extra 18 or 20 people to pick from in case somebody has a problem. So it's much easier to fill those deployments when we're over strength. The downside of that is it causes us to, our full-time manning is based not on the number of assigned, but the number that we're authorized. So our full-timers have to work harder, they have to take care of extra people, but we think it's a good trade-off in the end.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that $516 million in total economic impact, is that per year?
That was last year. It varies year to year, sir, but we run the numbers every year, and it a lot of it depends on how much construction we're doing. Mm-hmm. And also, last year was a big year. As mentioned, the trip to Lithuania, there were a lot of dollars spent in Minnesota as we railroaded a battalion's worth of stuff, which is a lot, from here to the port of, I think, Beaumont, and then it went over to Lithuania and came off the ship and went back on and came back. Kind of interesting.
Thank you.
Representative Miller.
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. Anyone that has not gone up to camp, maybe everyone here has been to Camp Ripley. Mm-hmm. I've not been to every training base in the U.S. I've been to many. And I mean with total sincerity that when I was up there this summer, Camp Ripley is probably one of the best facilities that I've seen, and you guys should be very proud of that whole complex, and that's something that the state needs to take some pride in. We have a great training facility up there.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, I'll just have one. Mr. Kerr, thank you for the presentation. And one comment for those of you that haven't had the National Guard called out to your committee, our community. I was board chair when we had the flood in Coochin County, and the governor called out the National Guard. They're amazing. They're absolutely amazing. They came in for, because we had people that could fill sandbags. We didn't have people that could put them out. And it's amazing. We can be proud of what our guard did up there. So, anyway, that's my comment on what you guys do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Members, we're just about done here. Next week we'll be back in Capitol 120, I think.
And Mr. Chair, is there any way we can get this room back? I mean, who do we have to put in a stranglehold or whatever? I know some wrestling moves we could probably do, but this, in terms of the size of our committee, this room is more appropriate for this committee. So.
Representative Detmer, let me make an inquiry on that, because I'd certainly rather have it here, and especially if that education committee is going to have more joint hearings, it would seem to me to make sense to have us here and them use that committee. And I know it's part of some of the new process and that sort of thing, but let me make a Owen's making a note of that, and we'll see what we can do. Next week, we'll have a presentation, and we'll also start hearing bills next week, as the way it looks right now for next week's agenda. So, DFL members, if you'd stick around here for about 2 or 3 minutes afterwards, I'd appreciate it. I just have some bills that came over from the Senate side that I'd like you to take a look at. With that, we're adjourned.